Guardian Unlimited.
I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Extra from Guardian Unlimited. The Harvard psychology professor Steven Pinker has written extensively about how humans use language to communicate. In his latest book, The Stuff of Thought, he draws upon areas of philosophy, physics, neurology, and anthropology to argue how the words we use tell us about the way we think. Well, I spoke to Professor Pinker, and as he told me, his new book continues his long-held fascination with the study of language.
The Stuff of Thought is a culmination of two trilogies. I previously wrote two books for a wide audience on language, The Language Instinct, which was an overview of everything you always wanted to know about language, and Words and Rules, The Ingredients of Language, which looked at the interaction between memory and combination in language, how you take little bits, words, prefixes, suffix, and assemble them into bigger bits, and how that's really the essence of language and what gives it its combinatorial expressive power. This one rounds out that trilogy by talking about meaning, something I didn't say a whole lot about in the earlier books, and also talking about use, how people use language in a social context. At the same time, it rounds out a different trilogy because I've written two books on human nature, how the mind works, self-explanatory, and a book called The Blank Slate on the denial of human nature in modern life and the moral and political and emotional colorings of the concept of human nature. So this one uses language as a window into human nature. That is, what can we learn about human thought and emotion and social relationships from words and how we use them?
Well, let's pick up on that. One of the early themes in the book is about whether language, as we know it, constrains our thoughts, or whether it's our thoughts that actually shape the language. Which side of that particular discussion do you come down on?
I argue that thought comes first. It's not true that the medium of thought is our mother tongue. That is, we don't think in English sentences or Japanese sentences if we grew up in Japan. And moreover, that it is possible to think thoughts that are not expressible in your language. When you think about it, it almost has to be that way. For one thing, how could you learn a language when you were a child if you were utterly incapable of thought without a language? How would you even figure out what words mean if you weren't able to think about the meanings of words without knowing the words? Language wasn't designed by a committee of Martians and handed down to us. Language emerges from people creating new words to express their thoughts, new idioms, new constructions. And if thought weren't primary, where would language come from historically in the first place?
So in a baby, then, you're arguing that there's a sort of a universal machine code grammar or something like this that we understand the essentials with which then language hangs on various details.
Yes, well, in fact, the baby has to have two things. One is an ability to register the world, to construe reality, that is to see things, think about things, make guesses about what the parent is trying to say when all those noises come out of the mummy and daddy's mouth. And they learn language by correlating their guesses to what the sentence means with the grammar of the sentence. I believe that's how language acquisition works. There has to be some ability to think about things in order to know how language expresses things. Separately from that, the child has to have some inkling of the logic of language, that it consists of assemblies of words that are ordered by rules, in order for the child to analyze those noises coming out of their parents' mouths, and rather than just reproducing the sounds like a tape recorder or like a parrot, chopping it into phrases and peeling rules off the analysis of the sentences.
One of the ways you examine that in the book is to look at the use of verbs. And verbs can be very instructive, especially when kids make mistakes in using these things. Can you take us through some of the examples in the book about how the use of verbs can uncover what our mental processes are?
Yes, I came to the subject matter of this book really from a technical concern with how verbs work and how children learn them when they acquire their mother tongue. Verbs are important because they are a framework for the clause. That is, once you pick the verb, it has slots in which the subject and the object and the various indirect objects are fitted. But when you look at different verbs, they work in different ways. Figuring out which verb does which thing forces you to put a magnifying glass on the contents of thought. So to give you a simple example, I worried for a while about why you can say, I poured water into the glass, but not, I poured the glass with water. I mean, you know what that means, but it sounds rather odd. On the other hand, with fill, the verb fill, you can say, I filled the glass with water, but not, I filled water into the glass. Then there's a third kind of verb, like load, where you can say, I loaded hay onto the wagon, or I loaded the wagon with hay. Three verbs for putting something somewhere, and they have different syntax.
Do babies make those mistakes?
Occasionally, yeah. Yes. And so, I've done experiments to see if they do. So occasionally, you'll hear a child say, "Oh, can you fill some salt into the shaker?" Although most of the time they get it right, but they do sometimes make errors, and they eventually turn into people like you and me, for whom pour the glass with water and fill water into the glass sound rather odd. I mean, one possibility is that these are just quirks. They're just irregular forms, and you memorize them one at a time, the same way you memorize that brought is the past of bring, but sang is the past of sing. That seemed unlikely, because if I give you a new verb that you probably haven't heard in a lot of constructions, you can kind of figure out where it belongs and where it doesn't. I think the answer is that it depends on the verb's meanings, and that the meanings are very precisely specified. So to pour basically it requires us to construe the action as doing something to water, namely causing it to move. Whereas to fill, we construe the same action as doing something to the glass, namely causing it to change state from empty to full. Now, it's the same stuff moving in the world, but we can construe it in two radically different ways, doing something to the glass, in which case the glass is the direct object, fill the glass with water, or doing something with the water, causing it to move, then it's the water that's the direct object, pour water into the glass. And that opened up a whole world for me. For one thing, it reveals what the basic elements of meaning might be, in this case, cause to move versus cause to change, and those elements keep popping up in verb after verb, and they make a difference to the kinds of sentences that you can use the verb in. They make a grammatical difference, as well as, of course, making a conceptual or difference in thought. But also, it shows the mind's power to construe the same situation in different ways, that the world itself doesn't stamp an interpretation onto our brains, but we always select among construals of the world, which always focus some aspects and hide others. And I think that's an ability that we see whenever you have disagreement or human interpretation. And the difference between construing an event as causing to go or causing to change writ large gives us some of our great controversies. Was there an invasion of Iraq, or was there a liberation of Iraq? Is stem cell research manipulating a ball of cells or destroying an incipient life? Are high taxes a way of redistributing wealth or confiscating earnings? In all these cases, the same situation in the world can be thought of in incompatible ways. And I think that's a basic power of the human mind, which is manifested in something as simple as construing what happens when water moves into a glass.
And it's the basis of all politics, isn't it, essentially?
It's politics and philosophy and law. And
the rich culture of human existence.
Exactly.
I mean, this idea of a sort of universal grammar, this idea that we aren't blank slates, which is what you wrote about in the book of that name, and further elucidated in books like The Language Instinct, where you say that language is something that is an instinct in humans, just as beavers building dams or spiders creating webs, these sorts of things. Isn't there an argument to suggest that if that was the case, genetically, there'll be variations in our ability to pick up language? I mean, some of your critics have said this. So what's your answer to that?
Well, there probably is genetic variation. In fact, we know that there's genetic variation at the extremes in cases of language impairment and language delay. There's increasing evidence that those are due to genetic variation. There's certainly quantitative variation in overall verbal ability. That's what the verbal reasoning portion of IQ tests picks up. And I suspect there is more fine-grained variation as well that's genetic, although that is not proven. We all know people who are more articulate, more tongue-tied, either prone to malaprops or extremely precise in their selection of words. Since just about every trait of individual variation has some basis in genetics. I suspect this one will eventually shown to be as well.
Moving on slightly, this idea that languages developed through human existence as a way for hunter-gatherer societies to sort of communicate with each other, and it's something that we need to survive. How then do we go from that and descriptions of objects in space around us and relationships, how do we go from that to quantum mechanics and yes. the sort of enlightenment things where you're thinking about objects and ideas which have no basis in what you can see or feel or talk about and touch?
A lot of science, at least the understanding of science, relies heavily on analogy. And the language of science is very often highly metaphorical. We understand, or we teach kids about the atom with analogy to the solar system, which we in turn teach with analogy to balls and things tugging against forces. We understand evolution in terms of selection on analogy to pigeon breeders originally. We understand chemistry and biology in terms of balls and sticks. So I think we often, perhaps always, root our understanding in science on physical intuitions. The reason that we're not stuck with those intuitions is that we have an ability for metaphorical abstraction. That is, we bleach out the content of our physical thoughts and preserve just the abstract structure, the relation between one thing and another thing, erasing what that thing actually is. Just as important, more important perhaps, is we have an ability to combine things. That is, simple thoughts can be assembled into more and more complicated thoughts, and they function as chunks in human thoughts. So you don't have to think back down to the lowest level of balls and sticks, but assemble thoughts into bigger and bigger units.
It's useful, I suppose, when you're talking about analogies and metaphors, to have someone, well, when you're talking to someone about those things, for them to come from the same sorts of culture then in that case, to understand what you're talking about. In science, because it's an international, supposedly language-free, I suppose, activity, it should work in any language. Isn't that the antithesis of what science is meant to be doing, which is to focusing in on a truth about, say, physics or something, a law of physics? If everyone's using different metaphors, how do we communicate those things together?
Well, I think there is a difficulty in scientific exposition if there isn't enough shared culture for people to have the analogies which they can extend to a real understanding. I mean, the content of science itself, as you note, of course, has to be free of a particular culture. And ultimately, even though the metaphor helps us understand something, together with the metaphor, you also have to have a set of instructions that tell you what to take seriously in the metaphor and what to ignore. So in the case of, say, natural selection, one has to be reminded that, yes, there are variant animals. In every generation, some are selected to reproduce and others aren't. But don't take it so seriously that you think that there's someone doing the selecting. That part of the analogy...
That's where you get to intelligent design.
That's where you get to intelligent design, and that would be a misunderstanding of evolution. So it's never enough to have a scientific metaphor. It has to be accompanied with instructions as to what to take seriously and what to ignore, and which means, by the way, that different physical experiences can be alternative metaphors. In each case, there'd be different instructions about what to take seriously, what to ignore, but the common core, after you've sloughed off the irrelevant bits, should be the same regardless of which metaphor you start off with. In some cases, they may not be a readily available metaphor. You might have to cobble together a number of things to get you a contraption that resembles what you're trying to explain. And of course, the ultimate metaphor that a lot of scientific discoveries are couched in are the metaphors that make up mathematics, where we learn arithmetic when we're children through the metaphor of accumulation. We learn division through the metaphor of chopping. Of course, we have to encapsulate those mental processes that we're not always going back to counting on our fingers. And we have to, of course, mathematics education, it's highly cumulative and hierarchical, so that you build up more and more sophisticated mathematical understanding, perhaps with some metaphor as a crutch each stage of the way. But the mental apparatus that corresponds to mathematics is ultimately what many scientific theories are framed in.
But do you think that leading scientists then, I mean, people who've really pushed boundaries, the people like Stephen Hawking, Albert Einstein, where they've pushed forward ideas into very, very abstract concepts, things like black holes, relativity, are they in your spectrum of people with different language abilities, would they be people who have a particular type of language ability? I mean, does it help to have a particular type of language ability to be a scientist, do you think, or to think in those ways?
I suspect that it does help to have this power of metaphorical abstraction. That is, one event, very concrete, reminds you of another, but you're capable of freeing yourself from the particulars of the original experience. Although in Einstein's case, it must be noted that the talent that he singled out in himself as being essential to his work was visualization and imagery, and he claimed to have arrived at his insights about relativity by, say, imagining himself riding a beam of light and looking back at a clock, or imagining himself in a plummeting elevator and noticing that gravity seemed to cease to exist. So for him, it was a kind of physical intuition. But crucially, it's not enough to have an image of yourself riding on a beam of light and looking at a clock. You've also got to be able to draw the right lessons from it and not get distracted by actually thinking of yourself as moving and being stuck with the intuitions that go along with it.
Let's move on to one of the slightly juicier areas of your book, swear words. I mean, you have great fun in this book listing swear words and talking about them. And one of the lines in your book is that essentially most swear words are in the following categories: sex, religion, excretion, death, infirmity, or disfavored groups. Can you give us an indication of, first of all, why we find these particular things worthy of swearing about? And then maybe step back a bit and say, well, what is it about swearing that it is so emotionally rewarding?
Yes. each one of the categories from which we draw our taboo words involves negative emotion. In the case of sexual swearing, it's the revulsion at sexual depravity. And just in general, the high emotion that surrounds sexuality, even in the most liberated cultures. In the case of disfavored groups, say taboo terms for ethnic and racial minorities, it's hatred and contempt of other peoples. In the case of religious swearing, it's awe and fear of the power of deities. In the case of death and disease, it's dread of infirmity and death. So in each case, there's a strong negative emotion. And I think the essence of swearing is the power to trigger a negative thought in the mind of your listener through the use of words. Now, why would we want to do it? Well, there are a number of different ways in which people swear. Sometimes we do it in order to remind people of how awful the objects or activities are. If we want people to not think about how terrible feces are, we use the word feces. If we want to remind them of how disgusting it is, we'll use the word shit. Likewise, if you're talking about sex in a positive context, you'd be likely to use the word make love. But if you talk about someone who's exploiting someone else, you might say, oh, he's fucking a secretary. And the word is deliberately used to highlight that which is most offensive about the activity. But we also use it cathartically. We hit your thumb with a hammer and you start blurting out words having to do with theology or excretion or sexuality.
Well, of course, I would say that the actual meanings of swear words seem to get lost in the expression, I guess. I mean, is it the emotional content that we're latching onto at that point?
That's all that's left, pretty much. That is when stub your toe and you yell out, oh shit. It has nothing to do with feces, other than the fact that feces are unpleasant and stubbing your toe is unpleasant. And you ordinarily inhibit yourself from saying shit. And there's probably a reflex, which I suspect we inherited from all the other mammals, where if you're suddenly injured, you erupt in a loud vocalization, presumably originally evolved to startle or intimidate an attacker, but that involves removing all inhibitions and an overflow of nervous activity into the parts of the brain associated with negative emotion, which in the case of humans involves these taboo words.
But why swear words, though? I mean, there could be all sorts of things that make you have huge negative emotions. I don't know, a musical, for example, if you hated it. And you might sort of say, instead of saying, oh, shit, or something, you might end up saying something like, oh, Phantom of the Opera, or something like that, because you hate that so much. I mean, but we don't do that. We use these particular words, which are kind of taboo and rude all the time.
And conventional. That is, they're shared across the community. Mm. And it is true that you have to learn what swear words to use with which misfortune. Mm. So even though in English the word whore is rather unpleasant and the word cunt is highly offensive and taboo, when you stub your toe, you don't yell out, oh cunt or oh whore. Though you do in other languages, in French and Portuguese, for example, you yell out puta or con. So you're right that there is a conventional aspect, and that suggests that swearing, as well as being a residue of this reflex, this rage circuit reflex, also has a communicative function, that the swear words that you pick advertise to a real or sometimes virtual audience of bystanders that you're currently in the throes of some extremely unpleasant emotion.
I suppose it's communication. If you said something that they don't understand, they wouldn't get why you're angry or upset.
Exactly right. Yeah. And in that regard, swearing overlaps with other exclamations in the language, like, you know, brr if you're cold, or aha, or mmm, or yuck, which also have no syntax. You just blurt them out as individual words, but they still convey a particular emotion.
Where do the most common swear words come from? I mean, you dispel some of the myths about where fuck comes from, for example.
The problem with tracing the origin of taboo words is that people don't write them down because they're taboo. So you have to do a lot of detective work. In the case of fuck, for example, the earliest known usage in the English language was a bit of rude graffiti carved outside a monastery in a kind of pseudo-Latin that basically said the monks inside will never get to heaven because they fuck the wives of the local town. And that's the first written inscription of the word. And that was, I think, from the 15th century. So it's an old word. But you can trace it back even farther if you look for cognates in other languages, that is, similar words in Scandinavian languages, in German and Dutch and so on. By that means, you can show that fuck comes from Scandinavian, and English does have a large number of Old Norse words. And it means to strike or to beat. It's a little bit like some of our rude terms for sex, like to bang. And it calls to mind a not very pleasing image of the sexual act, that of a man doing something violent to a woman, which we also see in some of the metaphors around sex, again, always around the taboo terms. They fucked him over, he got screwed, which allude to the underlying metaphor that to have sex is to exploit a woman. That's a conception that we all unconsciously recognize and acknowledge whenever we use an idiom like we got screwed, but it's something we consider not fit for polite company. And so all of the acceptable terms for sex, like have sex, make love, go to bed with, hide that conceptualization. The folk etymologies for fuck that you hear are that it's an acronym for, according to one story, fornication under consent of the king, and in another story, for unlawful carnal knowledge. And both of these are bogus.
Words like fuck also have completely their own grammar. They break all the rules. You can use them in any sense. I mean, there's the sentences which completely just have the word fuck in slightly different ways over.
This is fucking brilliant. What the fuck is he doing? Yeah. Sweet fuck.
Why is that? Why is it that swear words have this special status?
Yes. And as someone interested in grammar and syntax, this is a real puzzle. Like, you know, what the fuck is going on with the expression, what the fuck is going on? What's the fuck doing? What the fuck is the fuck doing there? And I think the answer is that this is a case where the use of the word is stripped to bare emotion clinging to it, the taboo status. And these historically originated from religious profanities that did make syntactic and semantic sense. It originally was, where in the hell are you going? You bring in hell to give a little emotional punch to your language. But as religion started to lose its emotional resonance with the general secularization of culture, you needed a substitute that would get the same emotional rise out of people when people stopped believing in hell. So you simply slot in another word like fuck that has a greater emotional impact, ignoring the fact that it doesn't mean anything. Likewise, Holy Mary was, as a curse, must have been quite shocking when Mary was this object of veneration. As people got a little more blasé about it, it was converted to holy shit or holy fuck, which make no sense whatsoever other than the fact that you can get the same rise out of people with shit and fuck that you originally could from Mary. Even our most common abusive imprecation with fuck you, doesn't make any sense. Shouldn't it be fuck yourself, for one thing? And what does it mean? I've asked people what they think it means, and it's interesting that no one really knows. Some people say, well, does it mean fuck yourself? And other people think, well, does it mean go get fucked? But then why would that be a curse? That would be like a wish
nice
for
thing.
Good fortune. It would be a nice thing. Some people think that it means I will fuck you. No one really knows. And I think that's informative. It suggests that it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
It basically is a conversion from damn you, or probably originally from may God damn you, which does make sense. But as people stop believing in literal eternal damnation, but still wanted to curse someone out and make them feel bad, they slotted in this other unpleasant word.
If I say the word fuck, and it kind of does imply a sort of misogynistic and attitude, I mean, can I say, well, actually, that was a long time ago, and I'm not meaning it that way? Or does a responsible person just say, well, actually, I've got to acknowledge the fact of where it came from?
Yes, there's something that feels misogynistic about swearing in general, curiously enough. Although women are swearing a lot more than they used to, swearing is still more of a guy thing than a woman thing. We have old notions like language that's appropriate for mixed company, mixed meaning men and women, and expressions like to swear like a sailor or to swear like a trooper, or locker room language, all alluding to the fact that swearing is considered masculine and that there's something offensive to women about swearing. And indeed, many guidelines for sexual harassment include the telling of sexual jokes as a kind of harassment, even though you'd think that just the topic of sex should be gender neutral, since it takes two. I think that is rooted in a basic feature of sexuality, that indiscriminate sex biologically works to the advantage of the male. And it's simply because women, there's a lot more at stake for a woman. She can get pregnant, and then she's stuck with the child. Whereas the male can get away with just a few minutes of copulation, and in principle, that could be the end of it. So women, in their behavior, in their emotions, are more discriminating when it comes to sex. The casual use of sexual language by connoting an atmosphere of licentiousness is felt to work to the advantage of men more than women. And in addition, as we've mentioned before, many sexual idioms have a rather unflattering image of sex as the damaging a woman or exploiting a woman. Not only we got screwed, but also, oh, my printer's fucked up, meaning broken, damaged. So I think the damage and exploitation metaphors have lost their misogynistic feel, but certainly overuse of sexual swearing can feel offensive to women. And as with any other aspect of language use, it would be common sense and common courtesy to anticipate how the language will affect your audience, depending on whether it's younger or older, formal setting or a more casual setting, used with a straight face or ironically. Swearing can be more or less offensive, and any careful speaker ought to anticipate the effects.
But we shouldn't ban swearing.
I don't believe the government should be in the business of banning swear words altogether. I think it's perfectly reasonable for individual newspapers, magazines, radio and television stations to have a house style. If people don't want to hear these words, there should be newspapers and radio stations where they don't have to hear those words. And I think that any proprietor of a popular medium, of a newspaper or radio station, is aware of that, and they're not going to use dirty words if it's going to offend their listeners. My own view is that that's none of the government's business, that the marketplace itself will enforce these standards.
In all that editing, in all this sort of the new words that are created, especially now in the technological age, hundreds of new words turn up every day, and some of them are horrible and tortured, but others like podcast, for example,
yes,
become
blog.
Very popular. Blog. What determines what sticks and what doesn't? I mean, again, people trying to impose rules never work. Back in the days of before we had the web, people were thinking everyone was going to call this the information superhighway, which never stuck and shouldn't have ever stuck.
Information superhighway, yes, I know. It sounds rather quaint nowadays, but then it used to be a technological cutting edge. I do talk about that in the Stuff of Thought. I have a chapter on the rise and fall of words and of baby names, which also change unpredictably.
Is it just fashion, or is it more?
I think
than
it really, a lot of it really is fashion, in the sense of not being a predictable product of some external social force, but rather having an internal dynamic where people react. This is in the case of baby names, which change by the decade. People react to the names that are already out there. They want a name for their child that is a little bit distinctive, but not too distinctive. And when you have millions of people going through that thought process, they will tend to end up with similar choices, and hence a name like Chloe or Amanda will be popular in one decade, whereas Linda, Susan, and Barbara were popular in an earlier decade. And with new words too, say with the name for the World Wide Web, there's also a great deal of chaos in which words will stick and which ones will fall by the wayside. No one could have predicted that the term for bulk email would have been spam, which comes from the famous Monty Python sketch of the waitress saying that the menu has eggs, spam, bacon, spam, spam, sausage, spam, and spam, where the mindless repetition reminded some computer hacker in the 1980s of identical postings to computer discussion groups. And for some unfathomable reason, it caught on within their community and then escaped to the world at large. And at the same time, other concepts that need a word will remain stubbornly nameless. We still don't have a good word for unmarried heterosexual partners, for example.
Are there any candidates for that?
Well, a lot of the official candidates are off by a little bit. My lover, it sounds a little too romantic if all you're talking about is, you're going to order pizza together with a woman or man you live with. Likewise, paramour. But roommate is not romantic enough. Someone suggested friend, as in, this is my friend. That didn't catch on. Partner sounds too gay. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but whenever I tell someone about my partner, I have to then explain, oh, by the way, my partner is a woman in this case. We don't have a good gender-neutral third-person pronoun to replace the clumsy he or she or the sexist he. We don't have a good word for the first decade of this millennium.
The noughties.
The noughties, yes. Yeah. I don't think that's caught on, certainly not in America. So there is some chaotic dynamics to the spread of new words, I think because a word is quintessentially a social phenomenon. You use a word to the extent that you think it'll be understood, which means if you anticipate that other people will use the word, and they're using it to the extent that they anticipate that you understand it. And so a word can very suddenly catch on if it gets enough currency that people feel confident that it's part of the language, which then makes it part of the language. In the other direction, if people are too hesitant in using a new word because they're afraid that no one else understands it, they won't use it, and it will lie in obscurity.
It's famously hard to predict what words are going to make it and what words aren't. You give the example of neen in your book.
Oh, yes.
Which is a word that came up from an artist to describe, what was it? The sort of effect of having something that's kind of technologically, artistically wonderful.
Yes, the new iPhone would be neen. And he also wanted it, when used as a noun, to refer to technologically inspired art forms, video art, computer graphics, computer animation, and so on. And he hired a company called Lexicon Branding. There are a number of companies, often staffed with linguists, who come up with names for products and companies. It all started with Exxon to replace Standard Oil and Esso, where they come up with a meaningless word that has pleasant enough connotations, but that doesn't actually stand for anything. In America, we have Verizon and a lot of car names, Alero, Sintara.
Classical names, aren't they?
They have a vaguely kind of faux Greek Latin, sometimes romance sound to them.
I wonder if this
Impreza.
I wonder if parts of that is also web addresses. You have to have something that's unique, because otherwise you wouldn't get the .com.
Yeah,
because I know lots of companies that reinvent their names for that specific reason, because otherwise they wouldn't get the web address.
Yes, although early on, a lot of companies were known by acronyms like IBM or by their founders like Ford and Westinghouse. Then there was a trend. Company names go through trends just like baby names. Then there were names that emphasized the immensity of the company, General Motors and General Mills and General Foods and United Airlines and so on. And it's a recent trend to have these neologisms, Altria and Acura, often dreamed up by very expensive consultants, Pentium. Anyway, this artist, Miltos Manatos, as part of this stunt, hired one of these companies. I think it was the same company that came up with Pentium, the name for the computer chip, and Alero, which is a brand of car, and Zima, which is a beverage. And they gave him a list of possible names for this new art form and aesthetic. And he chose one of them, an unfortunate choice, Neen, N-E-E-N. And he tried to lucid on the world at a happening at an art gallery to which the press had been invited with a lot of hoopla. There was coverage in the New York Times the next day. It was talked about on the web. But you've never heard of Neen, I mean, other than from my book. And I'm confident that no one listening to this podcast has heard of it either. So this is a case where someone pulled out all the stops to introduce a new word for a concept that needed a name, and it went nowhere.
If I was employing you as an expensive linguist to come up with a name for my product, I mean, do you have words that you think will catch on? Have you heard things which will catch on, you think, or do you think it's impossible? Will you not predict these sorts of things?
Well, in the case where you have a proprietary product, you've got the advantage that parents have when naming a baby, namely other people have no choice. And so if I release an iPod, I'm Apple Computers, if you want one, you got to stick with my choice. So there is an advantage there. It has to catch on almost always. Whereas if it's for a more generic concept, like an art form or a quality, then you're at the whims of the positive feedback loops and chaos of the linguistic marketplace. So if you had a product, I'd have a little more confidence. I haven't honed that skill myself in coming up with new sounds like that. I could. Well, and some, indeed, the job market for academic linguists is rather awful, but a number of them find work for these lexicon branding firms.
Stephen, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
That was Stephen Pinker speaking about his new book, The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window into Human Nature, which is out now. For more interviews like this and the very best analysis of science, technology and the environment, make sure you listen to Science Weekly at guardian.co.uk/science/podcasts.
Guardian Unlimited.